call the Committee of the Employee Benefits Programs Committee to order and ask council to call the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Turning to the roll, or before I call the roll, again, just a few announcements. This committee will operate as a interim committee does, similar to the meetings we had during the interim when Employee Benefits Programs Committee bills were considered. Also, just a reminder, when addressing the committee, please state your name and the organization or entity that you are representing so that we have that information for the record. And there should be a sign-up sheet attached to a clipboard. If you see that, print your name and pass it to the person next to you so that we can have a record of those in attendance today. Turning to the roll, Senators Dever.
Here.
Holmberg.
Here.
Kilzer.
Here.
Krebsbach.
Present.
Nelson.
Present.
Sorbach.
Here.
Representatives Bull.
Here.
Boehning.
Representative Boehning is here, but...
There he is.
There he is.
I'm here.
And Representative Brabant has arrived.
Brabant.
Brabant. Grandy.
Here.
Gugisberg.
Here.
Lauser.
Here.
And Wall. Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Okay, so all but one are present, so... Well, we have three bills that we need to consider. I understand that they have been considered by actuary, and we'll need to vote to accept jurisdiction on those, and we could do all three of those at one time if somebody would like to make a motion.
So moved.
Is there any discussion? I'm told that anybody can introduce a bill, but that we should scold people for going beyond the April 1st deadline. That was April 1st last year, not this year. So, having scolded,
do you need a roll call vote?
No, just, that's procedural, just a voice vote.
Okay, it's a procedural vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Opposed? No. Okay. Motion's carried. So we will accept all three. What we will do then is we will go through each of the three bills. We will invite the sponsors of the bills to introduce us to the bill, explain what they're going to do. And we will, I don't know, Faye and Sparb, if you'd prefer to go before the actuary or follow the actuary, whichever way you'd like to do it. So I'll see who stands up. And in this committee room, four microphones work at one time, so... Mine and three others, and if somebody says something I don't like, I push that button and it cuts that one off, so I feel powerful. So with that, let's move to House Bill 1203, and I think Representative Dropdall is the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I am David Dropdall, District 39 representative. And I'm the prime sponsor on House Bill 1203. What 1203 does is if a teacher retires and comes back to work, it exempts his share of the payment into the retirement fund. And the reason they were asked to do that was a fairness issue, simply because they don't get any benefits of any additional money that they put in. And we had two choices. One was to ask the TFFR to refigure the benefits as they contributed more, and the other was to just exempt them. And the simplest and the easiest one to work was just exempting them. And as I got up to speak, I was handed the fiscal note on it, and of course I was shocked. I think these retired teachers must be carrying the whole whole pension fund, but I'll leave that to your discretion. But that's what the bill does and why it's in front of you. And I'll make it simple and fast and be on my way.
Questions of the committee? Representative Dropdall, do you happen to know, I understand that a lot of school districts pay the employee side of the contribution and some don't.
That is, well, that's negotiated between the teachers and the school districts, but this bill doesn't exempt the school district share of it, but it would exempt the teacher share of it. If the teacher happened to negotiate, then the school district wouldn't have to pay that. But that's an individual negotiation at that level, and this refers to teachers. In my case, it happened to be hard to get teachers for classes such as math and science and music, where the small school districts cannot get a teacher or can't afford to pay one enough to come and rent a house in that area.
I should know, and maybe Faye can speak to this, but while they're returned to work, are they receiving retirement benefits?
Yep.
In almost all cases, yes.
Yep.
Okay. Can you explain why the effective date, July 1st?
I did know it at one time, but this time of the day, I can't remember if I'm coming or going, and I think it fits in better with the TFFR, if it happens to pass, it's more workable, the effective date that we put in. I think that was correct.
Contract date, okay.
Thank you, Representative Grandy.
Okay, and it's important to point out, too, that the purpose of this committee is to put a recommendation on each of these bills, and each will have an additional hearing in their respective chambers.
Mr. Chairman, this has already had a hearing in the respective committee in the House.
Is there a recommendation that we should consider from the House?
No, that has not been made yet, so you can still have your input into it, but they just surprised me and already scheduled it last week.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And Faye, would you like to go next? Are the actuaries here as a backup, or are they planning a separate?
TFFR.
Not with TFFR? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Turn the button on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Faye Kopp. I am the interim executive director for the Retirement and Investment Office, which is the agency that administers the Teachers Fund for Retirement Program. I do appreciate the opportunity to describe how House Bill 1203 would impact the TFFR Trust Fund, and I would also here to review the analysis conducted by TFFR's actuarial consultant. TFFR's actuaries are not present today to provide the analysis to you. However, I do have letters which I have attached to my testimony, and I've incorporated portions of their letters into my testimony so that it's all together. So I will be reviewing that as well as some background on the bill. On behalf of the TFFR board, I will note that I am testifying, however, in opposition to the bill, so that you're aware of that. As Representative Drevdahl indicated, this bill would eliminate the current statutory requirement that TFFR member contributions be paid on the salary earned by reemployed retirees. There's basically two sections of the law that this applies to. Section 1 relates to those that teach over or under a specified annual hour limit, and Section 2 deals with those employees who have returned to work in critical shortage areas. Due to the complexity of this particular program, I do have quite a bit of background information, as I know I've received an awful lot of questions about retiree reemployment. So, if possible, I would like to review that information with you, as I think it'll help as you analyze the bill. And then when we get to another bill that relates to this, I certainly would not plan to duplicate that background information. But if you would like, I'd like to kind of review it.
Sure. And
all right.
Thank you for not duplicating.
No. There's a lot here, though. I will warn you. But just to give you a little bit of background about this, current law does allow public school teachers and administrators, after a minimum 30-day requirement or break in service, to return to TFFR-covered employment and continue receiving their TFFR benefits, as long as they stay under certain employment limitations. The limits that we're talking about apply to TFFR-covered employment, but do not apply to substitute teaching, teaching in public colleges or university, employment outside of education, or employment outside of the state. Those, obviously, a retired teacher can do any of those things, and there's no impact on their TFFR benefit. Now, the maximum annual hour limit, which is that teachers are allowed to return to work under, is based on the length of that reemployed retiree's contract. So, for example, if a teacher goes back for 9 months, they can work up to a maximum of 700 hours in the school year and continue drawing their TFFR retirement benefit. If they work a 10-month contract, it's 800 hours, or if they're maybe an administrator and work a 12-month contract, they can work up to 1,000 hours at the school and continue drawing their benefits. Now, if the retiree stays under this general rule, they continue receiving their pension benefit, They would earn salary from the school and possibly benefits. That's, again, up between the employer and the employee to negotiate. And about, I'll note here that about 94% of re-employed retirees stay under this annual hour limit. So almost all of them are working part-time, staying under this annual hour limit. About 300 of them, by numbers.
It appears to me that that hour limit is approximately half-time.
It's roughly half-time. It's roughly 4 hours a day for 175 days, so it's maybe half-time all year, or maybe if it's a semester, it might be up to full-time. So something along that line, but typically it would fall under a half-time. Obviously, every school has a different number of hours per day, work day, and whatnot, so this is just sets up a certain number of hours for everybody across the board. Now, if the retiree exceeds this annual hour limit, and again, this affects only about 2% of our retirees, their monthly benefit is suspended, and then they are treated like an active employee, with their benefit possibly being recalculated upon subsequent retirement if they meet other certain conditions that are outlined in state law. So if you go over the limit, your benefit stops. You're not able to do both in those cases, and that's why when the question came up, you know, do they keep drawing their benefits? Well, most of them do. But this small group of people that exceed this annual hour limit, they will not continue drawing their benefits. So later on, we will recalculate their benefit. And that recalculation is outlined in state law. The example here is if the retiree returned to covered employment, had their benefits suspended and earned less than 2 years, we basically refund the contributions they paid in. If they earn 2 to 5 years of additional service credit, they get the greater of the old annuity that they were drawing before, plus an additional amount based on the years of service and the salary that they had during that period of reemployment. Or we'd use their whole career of teaching, and we'd recalculate it all at the current multiplier, less an actuarial offset for the amount of benefits already paid. And again, if they work over 5 years, they're getting another calculation. So again, keep in mind, this affects a small percentage of people who work probably up to full time, and they're not drawing their retirement benefit for most of that time. Now, there's one other way that retirees can return to covered employment, and that's under the critical shortage area exemption, which that's what Section 2 is referring to. In that case, retirees can return in an approved critical shortage area. They can also exceed the annual hour limit, which means they can work up to full time, and they too would continue receiving their monthly pension benefits. So they're going to be kind of like those that stay under the limit, but in their case, that reflects about 4% of the retirees, or last year about 13 retirees worked under this option. In order for them to work full-time and keep drawing their benefits in a critical shortage area, however, they need to have a one-year waiting period out before they go back. So they can't retire 1 year and go back full-time the next. They have to be out for a full year before they're able to do that. And then it would be in a critical shortage area that's determined by the Education Standards and Practices Board. For the current fiscal year, ESPB has designated all areas except for elementary ed and FIED as critical shortage areas. Now keep in mind that prior to 7-1 of 12, the employer paid the employer contributions on the salary earned by reemployed retirees, both under the general rule and in critical shortage areas. At that time, or prior to 7-1 of 12, no member contributions were paid. However, with the passage of 1134 in the last legislative session, beginning this school year, member contributions are also required to be paid on salary earned by reemployed retirees. As also was indicated by Representative Drevdahl, depending on the negotiated agreement between the school districts and the teachers, the member contributions are either paid by the retiree through a salary reduction, or they are paid, at least all or a portion of it might be paid, might be picked up and paid by that school district. The reemployed retiree's pension benefit does not increase as a result of the additional contributions paid, unless, of course, their benefit was suspended because they exceeded that annual hour limit. However, the member contributions are included in their guaranteed account value. Now, I did include an example here to help kind of clarify that general rule, what we typically see happening with the retirees that go back to work. And so the example here is, let's say you've got an individual who's age 58, has 30 years of service credit, and receives an average annual salary of $50,000 as an active teacher. He's eligible for retirement, so he resigns from his position, and he retires from the school district. His TFFR benefit would be calculated as follows. It'd be his $50,000 final average salary times 30 years of service credit times the 2% multiplier, which means he'd get about $30,000 annual TFFR benefit if he retired under the single life annuity option. After he retires, if he waits at least 30 days, he can return to covered employment on a limited basis, continue receiving that $30,000 benefit. As a 9-month teacher, he can work up to 700 hours. He can earn salary and pay from the school district and continue drawing his benefit. If he earns $25,000 from the school district, as an example, plus the $30,000 paid from TFFR, he'd be receiving a total of $55,000 total between TFFR and the school. Now, under current law, member contributions are required, times 9.75 to get to about $2,400 is what he is either paying or what the school is paying on his behalf, if the school has negotiated that agreement. Employer contributions are also required to be paid, in this case, of about $2,700. As noted here, his benefit does not increase as a result of returning to teach. However, he is able to continue receiving his benefit while employed half-time at the school. Now, during the last fiscal year, there were 318 reemployed retirees. The average age was about 62. Average salary earned was $24,500. That $24,500, though, keep in mind, could be anywhere from $500 if someone just came in and worked on a very limited basis, to up to, you know, $100,000 in salary if it's an administrator working in a critical shortage area, as an example. So that's quite a range of salaries that could comprise. Now, there are 132 school districts or employers that employ these 318 retirees, with four retirees actually working in two school districts. And again, these school districts or employers range anywhere from reemploying one retiree to, in some of the larger districts, up to 17 or 18 retirees are going back to work on it, typically a part-time capacity. Of the total, most of them worked part-time under that annual hour limit, and I mentioned all of that earlier. Of the 318 retirees last year, 78% were teachers or special teachers, 14% were principals or other administrators, and 8% were superintendents. So far this year, we have reported to us 252 reemployed retirees. However, by the end of the year, we do anticipate that there will be a similar number as there's been in the last few years, right around that 300-plus range. Now, I do have a couple additional charts that you may want to just take a peek at. If you would just turn two more pages, you'd see something that says 2011-12 Retiree Reemployment Summary Statistics. Now, on the top, I've already provided you with that information, but if you look at the bottom, you'll see a chart that shows how the number of reemployed retirees has grown over this nine-year period, from 92 people in 2004 to 318 last year. You can see for the last 4 or 5 years, it's remained relatively constant around that 300 retiree remark. If you turn the page, you can see how the number of reemployed retirees by hours contracted. Now, as I mentioned, some retirees may go back to work and work a very small amount, and some are working up to full time. So this kind of gives you a glance at what they're doing. If you look at the top left-hand side, you'll see that full-time critical shortage areas, it's about 4% of the retirees. Full-time suspend and recalculate option, about 2%. But then you look at all the part-timers that are staying under the general rule. For those that are working, say, somewhere between 1 hour and 300 hours, that's about 25% of the total number. 300 to 600 hours, about 19%. And about 50% of the retirees, of the total number of 300, are working somewhere in that 600 to 1,000 hour range. So you can see, again, they're working from a very limited part-time all the way up to full-time. The next page, page 3, shows by subject position. Again, taking those 300 retirees and saying, well, what are they doing? What are they working in? And again, you can see it's all over the board. Virtually every type of position is covered here, with, you know, a large percent, maybe 5% in counseling, 7% in elementary ed, 4% math, 7% science, a lot of special ed, 13% in this case. And then, of course, superintendents, principals, and directors, you know, 5 to 10%. So just kind of shows you, I think, at a glance that they're doing a little bit of everything. And finally, on the back of that page, just kind of takes that same 318 retirees by option. So again, this is what I had showed you earlier, that last year about 94% of the retirees returned to work under the general rule. That's been pretty consistent over this 8 or 9 year period. And again, by job type on the bottom, you can see that 75 to 80% of those that have returned to work have been classroom or special types of teachers, with the other, you know, 5 to 15% being the principals and administrators. So again, that's been relatively constant over this period of time. So quickly going back to page 3 of the testimony, I would just note, under 2011 legislation, as those of you in the room know, in the last session, the board did submit a comprehensive package of benefit and contribution changes that were studied during the interim and approved by the 2011 legislature. Those changes were designed to improve our funding levels over the long term and reduce the unfunded liability of the plan. Now, one of the core principles upon which our proposal was based was that funding improvement responsibilities should be shared. For example, increases in both member and employer contributions would be made. Benefit reductions would be for both new and current employees who are more than 10 years away from retirement. No retirement increases for current retirees, and as part of that, the requirement that member contributions be paid for those retirees who do return to work and continue to receive their pension benefits. Now, without a doubt, you know, no member, active or retired, wants to pay more contributions for the same or reduced benefit structure. I'd also add that obviously no employers want to pay more in contributions. However, it was determined to be in the best interest of the plan as a whole for all the parties to share in these funding practices. And I think, as you recall during the last session, that there was support from both our employers and active teachers, administrators, and retirees for that bill. This is the first year that TFFR has collected member contributions on reemployed retirees. So obviously, in order to implement the legislation, both our plan as well as all of the school districts had to make the necessary software changes to start collecting those contributions. In addition, during that period of time, it's our understanding that in some cases, employers gave retirees salary increases that would be large enough to cover at least all or a portion of those member contributions that they are now required to pay. Or in other cases, if the employer pays the member contributions for active employees, the employer also began paying the member contributions for reemployed retirees. Each school district, as was noted earlier, makes their own decisions regarding employee pay and benefits. But in many cases, it appears that reemployed retirees may not have had received a pay cut as a result of the new provision. With that said, certainly, you know, it's very likely that some did. But we've certainly seen many cases where that has not happened. Now, I've attached the full actuarial analysis from Siegel Company to this report, or to this testimony. I'll briefly go through it as part of my testimony. What Siegel has indicated in their January 21st letter is that the impact of eliminating member contributions on reemployed retirees would be a reduction in contributions to the system of approximately $780,000 based on a current reemployed retiree salary of $8 million. Beginning in fiscal 2015 and each year thereafter, the impact would be about $1 million in lost contributions. The impact on TFFR for each year will certainly depend on the number of reemployed retirees that fall under these particular provisions. Now, according to the actuary, the impact on unfunded liability would be the amount of contributions that would no longer be collected, or approximately $1 million per year. And there would be a small negative impact on the funding ratio of the plan going forward. Eliminating the provision associated with collection of member contributions for reemployed retirees will mean that it will take longer for TFFR to achieve its funding goals. You'll also note that I was asked to complete a fiscal note on this particular bill. Just a quick summary of that here as well. Based on Siegel's review of the bill, based on that letter, what you would see is in the 2013-15 a savings of approximately $624,000 to school districts and approximately $802,000 for school districts for the following biennium. Now, on its face, one would expect that passage of this bill would only affect those reemployed retirees and that it would have no fiscal impact on the state or the school districts. But obviously, it would affect those employers who pay the member or the retiree contribution into TFFR. Currently, about 40% of TFFR employers who employ retirees have agreed through the negotiations process to pay all or a portion of those member contributions. Therefore, if you take that $780,000 times the 40%, you get $312,000 times 2 years in the biennium. That's where you get the savings then to school districts of approximately $624,000 for the first biennium and $800,000 for the second biennium. And that number, of course, would continue to increase each biennium depending upon the number of retired members and their salaries. In addition, if there are any state educational institutions that employ TFFR retirees, a reduction in expenditures would also be realized since the state pays 4% of the contribution into TFFR. So in summary, House Bill 1203 does remove one of the TFFR-related provisions just approved in the last session. As a result, TFFR will receive about $1 million less each year in member contributions. Because it has a negative impact on TFFR funding and is expected to result in it taking longer for TFFR to reach its long-term funding goals and to reduce those member and employer contribution rates, the board opposes the bill. The board continues to believe that all members, both active and retired, and employers should share the responsibility for TFFR's long-term funding improvement. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this does conclude my testimony on House Bill 1203, and I'd be happy to respond to your questions.
Are there questions? Yeah, it might be early to make an assessment, but I'm curious if, since we changed it, if there's a difference now in the perspective of teachers retiring.
Okay.
If they might delay retirement because they're not going to receive, or they're going to need to make those contributions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think you're right in your first assessment. It may be a little bit too early to identify if passage of the last bill, where they're having to pay retirement contributions, if that's going to affect the number that go back, that's kind of one piece of it. And right now, we're not seeing that it is having any impact. You know, we're estimating that we're going to have the same number go back this year as went back last year.
Okay.
On the additional side, if a bill like this would pass or others that would pass, those could be bills that might incentivize employees to retire sooner. And if they would retire sooner, then there too could be an actuarial impact on the plan. And so, again, too early to identify that, but it will be a consideration, I think, in any one that is retiring as to when they make that determination of when they're going to retire, they're going to think about what they're going to do after retirement. And so whatever these provisions are may have an impact on that, whether they would choose to retire sooner or later as a result of those.
Sure. Senator Holmberg.
Faye, could you refresh my memory at least? Under current law, the teacher has to be out a minimum of 30 days, a break in service. Is that a break in actual teaching or a break in their contract? In other words, are they out, I mean, they get done June 1st, they would automatically be eligible starting that August or September. So really, the break is kind of meaningless if they're retiring at the end of a typical school year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Holmberg, members of the committee, certainly for teachers, that 30-day break in service may not have as much impact as it would for an administrator. For IRS purposes, they require a very minimum of at least 30 days in order to ensure that that employee really has ceased their employment. I mean, that's the issue from the IRS and from the retirement plan as well. We need to at least ensure that they've resigned from their position, they're not under contract to work the next year, so they need to be, you know, started drawing that benefit, and then after that point in time, if they choose to go back to work, you know, then they can sign another contract. So they must break that contract first, and then be out, start drawing their benefit, and then they may go back.
Other questions? If not, Faye, did you have anybody else that was going to testify on this?
Not from our office.
Okay.
I'm not sure if any of the member or employer groups are planning to or not.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess we started with opposition. Is there anybody that would like to speak in support of House Bill 1203? Anyone to speak in opposition to House Bill 1203? The reason we want you to sign the clipboard is so council knows how to spell pulvermarker.
It is a mouthful, I'm aware. Chairman Dever and members of the Employee Benefits Committee, my name is Kayla Pulvermacher, and I'm here representing the North Dakota Education Association. I stand in opposition to 1203 as it relates to the Teachers Fund for Retirement. NDEA is committed to working along with all education stakeholders to preserve TFFR. During the last session, NDEA was part of the effort behind House Bill 1134, which served as a recovery plan for TFFR. Because the bill would have a negative impact on the fund and would result in TFFR taking longer to reach its funding goals, NDEA is opposed to the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee, and I am available for any questions you may have.
Questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
Anyone else to speak on House Bill 1203, on any position? In favor, opposed, neutral? Seeing none, we will move from, committee, we'll need to be putting a recommendation on each of these bills, but since the next one, I think, is a different approach to the same issue, maybe we'll wait until we're done with all three and go back. So with that, let's move to Senate Bill 2331. Senator Heckman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here to just talk a few minutes on Senate Bill 2331. If you look at the sponsorship on this bill, you will see it is very small. I also have to say that I have a conflict of interest on this bill because I am a rehired teacher, and I'll explain that in a minute. This is not a bill on my behalf. This has been a constituent concern that I have discussed with the constituent and finally came to the come to Jesus understanding that I better put it in and for my constituents, because that's what I'm down here to serve for. And so my constituent will be here to testify on this bill. I will present it. I will not testify. But this bill presents a little bit different take on retired individuals. And my constituent would like some kind of a benefit increase for the amount that he is paying into the retirement system. And while I'm a math teacher with a pretty good background in probability and statistics, I told him it would be very minuscule, and he said he doesn't care because it's the principle of the thing. And the principle of the thing for him is the fact that with the understanding of the testimony and some of the talk from 2 years ago is that this teacher that's rehired will be taking the position of another person that would be paying in. And his point is, but there will not be a person in that position drawing any of that money back out. There's not, if he's teaching Spanish, he's in there retired, he's putting money into the system, there's not going to be a Spanish teacher in that position retiring and drawing out. So that he will present that information when he comes to the committee when the bill comes up. I'll tell you a little bit about my history. I retired from teaching in 2004. That was in May. In the fall of 2004, I was called by the reservation school at Spirit Lake. They needed special education staff, and they couldn't find anyone to staff the position. So I started as an hourly basis for them up there, and that's a Bureau of Indian Education, so it didn't matter on my retirement for that. I worked 4 years for them in a combination of either part-time or full-time employment, teaching and case managing K through 12 students with emotional disabilities. Going into the 2009 session, I became Brett Favre. I retired again. And I lasted until the fall again. And they needed someone to help at the alternative school because my first degree is high school math. They couldn't fill that position. So I started in the fall for them to fill a position. And when it came to the spring again, I said, you need to find somebody, so I retired again. And then the next year, they came again, and they went till October, and they couldn't fill a position, so I'm back. I've been back. I worked this semester part-time for the Bureau of, not the Bureau, the public school up there. I work on, so I'm half-time of half-time right now, because during the session, I'm not there. But my point is that these retired teachers are not back because they're looking for a job. I'm there because I'm filling a need for the school in order to get accredited by the state of North Dakota. So you have to look at it that position when you look at that point when you look at retired teachers. I serve at an alternative high school. We have four retired teachers working there, and any of them on any given day would give up their position for a young staff person to come in to take a position in North Dakota to continue teaching in that position. I have a basic agreement with the superintendent, the director of the alternative school, and the school board, that if you find someone that calls your school or you've got the position out there or whatever and somebody wants to come in, I'm done the next day. Because I'm not there to take another teacher's position. I'm there to fill a need for the school to stay accredited and also to give the students an education in math. And so I will return in May the day after I'm done down here, which I hope will be the 1st of May, the 2nd of May, and finish up with my students that need to finish up their math for graduation. But I think you need to understand that there is not a person in my position that's going to take any retirement money out of the retirement fund. And that was my constituents' concern, that there is not a person in there. So I do have to tell you, conflict of interest, I will present the bill, I will not speak in committee on it one way or the other. I may, I'm sure, I don't know, be in GBA with Senator Dever, and so we'll, if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer the same or give the same, you know, as I did today. So that's what this bill is, to increase the retirement on the portion that the employee pays in. And I think it's going to be very minuscule, I think. So,
so the previous bill was to eliminate the contribution. This one is to increase the benefit.
This one will keep the contribution in there, but to get a small benefit, which probably is the same apples to apples, same result. You know, one or the other, it's going to be about the same result, I would imagine. So, and I have to tell you that in my position, the school pays because they're glad to have me there so they can stay accredited. In my constituent's position, I can't answer him. I think he or others in are maybe paying out of their own pocket for that. So,
any questions? Let me just say that I appreciate your honesty, the compassion that you have for teaching, and let me suggest that, that maybe you review the requirements for that define a conflict of interest, because I know among them is whether or not it is a unique benefit to you, and it's a benefit to a lot of teachers, so I'm not sure that you necessarily have that conflict.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Well, if we were to vote on it on the floor and you wanted to express that, you would bring it up, and the Senate would vote on whether or not you're able to vote on it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. I didn't see any questions. No, I don't have any. Go ahead, Faye.
Would you like me to begin?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Faye Kopp with the Teachers Fund for Retirement. I am distributing testimony, but I will probably omit about the first three or four pages of it. I'm just noting that certainly the sponsor of the bill, I did want to make sure, though, that you had it for purposes of documentation for this bill, or if these two bills get separated, that you certainly have all the information you need on others. So it is duplicated. The parts that are different is what I'll review. Obviously, summary of the bill, as the sponsor indicated, this would provide an actuarial adjustment to increase benefits based on the total amount of retired contributions that are paid to the fund during that period of retiree reemployment. That benefit adjustment would be done after the retiree re-retires, and which would be at the completion of the member's reemployment. So there's going to be a lot of repeating in this. The benefit adjustment would be paid effective the first day of the month following the retired member's re-retirement. So I will, again, the next two sections under retiree reemployment background information and 2011 legislation is the same as was heard in the previous bill. So I'll go to page 4 under the actuarial analysis. Now, as you know, this bill was just filed on Monday. The actuary provided me with this analysis last night. So it's pretty much hot off the press. It, too, is attached, but I have incorporated the pertinent parts of it into my testimony. But this is the actuarial analysis on page 4. In the letter, they noted that they had also conducted an analysis on the other bill. And so there are some comparisons between the two bills here. While House Bill 1203 and 2331 both impact retired member contributions, they are contradictory to one another. 1203 eliminates the retired member contributions during reemployment, while this bill returns the member contributions over time by actuarially increasing the benefits upon subsequent retirement. Now, according to Siegel, the impact of adjusting the benefits would result in an increase in the liability of approximately $780,000 for 2013, or up to about $1 million in 2015. Obviously, the impact each year will depend on the number of reemployed retirees that fall under this and their payroll. To the extent that reemployed retirees live longer or shorter than expected, the actual impact on the fund will be more or less than the additional liability and will be recognized then as either a gain or loss. If this bill was enacted, it would be a small negative impact on the funding ratio of the plan going forward, and it would take longer for TFFR to achieve its funding goals. The actuary notes that the impact of both the previous bill and this bill are similar. Both bills address it, the contributions collected during reemployment. The actuary notes that consideration should be given as to whether the additional administrative costs associated with this bill would warrant passage of the other bill, which eliminates those member contributions as opposed to increasing their benefit upon subsequent retirement. And we'll be talking more about the administrative implications later on. Another point that the actuary brings out is whether or not the provisions of this bill will result in active members retiring earlier than they ordinarily would have in order to become reemployed retirees, who would then be eligible for an increase in benefits upon subsequent retirement, especially in those school districts where their employers pay the member side of the contributions. So this could potentially incentivize those people that are thinking about retiring at 55 or 57, if they're thinking they may be able to go back and their benefit may be increased as a result of additional contributions paid. And since they aren't paying those additional contributions, they may be picked up by their employer in those examples, then it certainly might be an incentive to retire a little bit earlier than they would have maybe otherwise planned. And again, one can never, the decision to retire is a very personal decision and based on that employee's, determination of when the best time is. But again, recognizing that if some would do it sooner, there could potentially be a greater liability on the plan. Now, the chart that's included in this testimony, and again, it's from the actuarial letter, this shows examples of the increase in a reemployed retiree's benefit based on various member contribution totals. So these are just sample hypothetical totals. First one says, let's say that retired member contribution totals only $50. This could be someone that worked for 1 year for, picked up one class or one extracurricular for a couple of months, and they got $500 in salary or something. So let's say they paid in about $50 in contributions. We would be recalculating the benefit, and they would receive an additional 38 cents in their monthly retirement benefit if they re-retired at age 60. So in this case, let's say they, went out at 58 or 59 and re-retired at age 60. They get an additional 38 cents in that scenario. The second column says, what would their benefit, how much would it increase if they re-retired at age 65? Now, this is one extreme, okay? And you'll see the other extreme here. More common are going to be those contribution totals of maybe $5,000 or $10,000. In those cases, it might be an employee that went back to work for 1 year with a $50,000 salary, or maybe they went back to work for 5 years with a $10,000 salary or $15,000 salary, which means their contributions that are paid in might be $5,000 or $10,000. In those cases, their benefits may go up another $37 or another, $75, depending upon what their total contributions were after they had completed that reemployment period. So it's basically taking whatever that total is, spreading it out over an anticipated lifetime. Some people will draw out more than those contributions that were paid in. Some will draw out less, depending upon how long they live after retirement. The actuary does state it'll take 10 to 11 years for a reemployed retiree to recoup the member contributions that were collected. Siegel also notes that this bill will require staff to, of course, revise various communication materials that we did just change last session. In addition, we'll need to program costs for TFFR in order to determine the additional monthly benefit that's going to be based upon the reemployed retiree's retirement. It increases the complexities surrounding this, as there will be added administrative costs associated with educating members on how the provisions work and providing estimates of service benefits under a variety of alternative scenarios. As was described earlier by the actuary, if the intent is basically to refund the member contributions, pay it out over their lifetime, it would be administratively simpler to just eliminate payment of those contributions. And as is also indicated, the increase in monthly benefits is minimal for member contribution totals that are very low. As it relates to administrative issues, now again, the other points were made by the actuary. These certainly are made by staff in just kind of analyzing this as well. In order to implement this type of a bill, there's a number of issues that would need to be addressed. Certainly, we would need to determine exactly when that retiree is considered to be re-retired. Now, that might sound very simple, but we know, as the previous speaker mentioned, that sometimes they think they're done in May, and then they get another call back by the fall. So we would need to wait until they are definitely re-retired before we would start recalculating their benefit, which means they would need to resign from their positions, apply for re-retirement, and would need to indicate and prove to us that they're not under contract for that next year. Otherwise, why would we go through this whole recalculation? We'd just be calculating and recalculating every summer. We'd need to, of course, work closely with the employers regarding accurate and timely reporting of retired member contributions. Remember, they just started taking in the contributions last year. They're starting to get their systems underway, but that's going to become more and more important. Once all these payments are received and reconciled, we would have to begin the process of determining the account values, reviewing applications and documentation, confirming that they've not returned, and finally calculating the necessary benefits. The process itself would likely take 3 to 6 months, similar to the length of time it takes for an employee to begin applying for a regular retirement. Oh, okay. It would be a similar process.
Okay.
Yes.
I think you got it.
Okay. administrative rules would need to be promulgated, and you know, we're talking about the complexity of the plan. If we go on to the fiscal note, there is no direct fiscal impact to the state or school districts as a result of this bill because contributions are still being paid in. In summary, the board does oppose this bill for similar reasons to the first one, in that in this case the liability is expected to increase by about $1 million per year. And so I would certainly be happy to respond to your questions.
Questions? Representative Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, my question is the 40%, I think we heard, that of the school districts that pay both sides. Mm-hmm. Is that a number that is static, or is that fluctuated? They have the right to do that at any time, or is that grandfathered in from some point?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the 40% number that we used is we took that 318 retirees and we checked to see what if their employers were picking up their contributions or not. So that 40% is static to that group of re-employed retirees and their employers. With that said, in general, about half of all of the employers pick up active member contributions, and that is part of the negotiated agreement. Therefore, as teachers and school districts negotiate that each year, that is something that could change. It typically stays pretty similar, but for example, when the contribution increases went into effect in the last session, there's probably about a dozen school districts that decided not to pick up and pay the additional contributions. Most of them did decide to continue picking up the member contributions, but in some cases they did not. So it can change.
Okay. I don't see any other questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Faye. Let me ask one quick question, and that is, when the bills come up for hearing in committee, do we receive a fiscal note or do we just receive the actuarial report?
You would receive both. I mean, the fiscal note is, of course, out there, but this committee, I will always share the actuarial information with the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else to speak on Senate Bill 2331? Let me mention, for the benefit of the members of my caucus, that I did inform our majority leader that we may be late to ours. So, yeah, we're talking about tax relief. So, if anybody has an interest in our support of that, you may want to keep your testimony short.
I can do that for you. Chairman Dever and members of the Employee Benefits Committee, my name is Kayla Pulvermacher and I'm here representing North Dakota Education Association, and I stand in opposition to 2331 as it relates to TFFR. My testimony is pretty much exactly the same as it was earlier, because the bill would have a negative impact on the fund and would result in TFFR taking longer to reach its funding goals. We are opposed. I can take any questions you may have.
Okay. Just real quick.
Yes, sir.
The stakeholders did come together, did put together a proposal that represented some sacrifice on the part of some, and to make changes to that now is kind of...
Chairman Dever, that would definitely be our position.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else to speak on Senate Bill 2331? If not, then we will move from Senate Bill 2331 to House Bill 1452. Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, for the record, Representative Jim Casper, District 46 in Fargo. I will be much more brief than the previous speakers. And I have the experts here to give you the technical knowledge on 1452. 1452 is simple. It's a bill that provides an option for currently hired employees in the North Dakota PERS plan and newly hired employees in the North Dakota PERS defined benefit plan to go into a defined contribution plan. Plain and simple. It's their choice. If they transfer, there are certain transfer rules in the bill. There is an actuarial cost, but there are ways that we're going to be looking at to maybe soften that a little bit. Some of the actuarial reports just came out yesterday, which Barb can tell you about. That's the bottom line of the plan, of the bill.
Questions? Has this bill been heard now in the House?
Tomorrow, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The other, I might add, Mr. Chairman, being a new chairman of the GVA committee in the House, not anywhere near as knowledgeable as the former chairman, Representative Grandy. The bill came up, we heard it, and then I was told it should have been here first, so my apologies. But we'll be happy to do it over again if you would like us to.
That wouldn't be necessary, but there are added perspectives, I would imagine, that you might see.
Well, I heard it all then, as I heard tonight. It hasn't changed.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting concept, and you know, I think these kinds of things have implications that mm-hmm. aren't not necessarily readily apparent. And
that's true, Mr. Chairman.
Are involve some serious mm-hmm. consideration. So.
Okay. For technical questions, Barb and the actuaries are here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Barb, are you going to speak, or the actuaries, or how are we going to do this? And let me just mention that there are some people anxious to be elsewhere, so...
Yes. you heard that, Brad?
I heard you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, what we'll do is our actuary here is with the Siegel Company, Brad Ramirez, and I'll hand you the actuary report. It's got a lot of details in it, but he'll just focus on with you some of the cost information, and then I'll follow up with how that cost, how that contribution information relates to the dollars in things. And as Representative Casper mentioned, this just came in yesterday, I'll be working with him to go over these details and things as well. So I'll pass this out. Brad will talk about some of the touch on some of that actuarial, and I think it's page 2 or 3. And
we have the Siegel report.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Ramirez with the Siegel Company. I will cut to the chase, as has been directed to me, and talk about the costs of the plan, or the costs of the bill, as we see them. And on page 2, there is a table. I'll refer you to that table. There are basically, essentially, two elements of cost in the bill. The first element is the initial transfer of people. Given the option, people that are currently in the PERS plan can elect to move out and take with them liability and assets. The way the bill is currently worded, the liability they would be taking would not exactly correspond to the assets, because the bill is it says to take 100% of the liability with you in assets. Because the plan is not fully funded on an actuarial basis, they're actually taking a little bit more than would have been on average for a person who's already there. So the people, essentially what that means is the people that are remaining would be left with unfunded that was not taken or that was given to them by the people who left. So that I may have butchered what what's going on there, but that's the idea. They've taken more assets than they have on average in the plan, and so the rest of the people that remain have to pay for it. So that's one, that's a significant cost element of the bill. The second cost element is future contributions, because people, when they join service, are going to be able to elect to either go to the DC plan or go into PERS. The PERS is currently funded as a percentage of payroll for ongoing members, and when you cut that payroll going forward, what's going to happen is people elect out, there's going to be less payroll that we see in the future that's going to be coming to pay for those benefits. And because the unfunded still exists, over time, if you have a smaller base of payroll to pay for or to use to pay, and the unfunded is the same, the cost as a percentage of pay will go up. Okay, so those are the two main elements. Now, there are two main assumptions that go into this. Number one is the amount of people that who will elect to leave immediately when the bill is passed, and then number two, the amount of people that elect going forward when they are hired, the people that elect to go to DC or DB. So we have to make some assumptions, some very broad assumptions about what people are going to do, which is very difficult. What we did in this table is we did sort of a conservative and to more aggressive range of assumptions for people leaving. The two numbers that you see, the 10%, let's say in column, that's labeled column one, 10%, 5% basically means 10% of the group as it currently exists would leave to the DC plan, and going forward, 5% of all new hires would elect to go into a DC plan instead of the DB plan. And then the same for number two and for number three. And you can see number three is quite aggressive. That would mean 20% of the people would currently in the plan would leave, elect to leave, and 15% of all ongoing hires would go into the DC plan instead of the DB plan. Now, we frankly don't know who or where we're going to fall on this in reality. We looked at some of the elections. There's currently a group that can elect to go into a DC plan, and we looked at sort of their patterns and how that worked. And then we came up with number two as sort of our best estimate at this time, the 15%, 10%. And that means 15% of the people will elect and leave immediately, 10% ongoing will go into the DC plan. And the costs associated with each of these groups, you can see going down the line, the PERS main group, the people that remain, the current cost rate, the actuarial valuation cost rate is 12.24. Under the new plan, we would estimate that the cost would be about 13.9. So there's an increase of about 1.66% of future pay. For judges, we moved from 16.33 to about 17.97, which is an increase of 1.64. Law enforcement, 10.69 to 11.45, and National Guard, 7.4 to 7.86. So those are the cost elements as we see them. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Grandy.
Chairman, just kind of quickly, as I looked at this and thought about it, what kind of numbers you were going to come with, I would have flipped it. And I would have saw those that are currently in, a smaller percentage, but those coming in is the bigger percentage.
Okay.
Just that was kind of, I found this interesting scenario mm-hmm. as I was reading it. My question, though, is really regarding, we talk about they're going to take out that 100% and that's going to be less, but then again, they're not going to be at the end in that long-term projected higher salary rate where they would have been drawing off of the account. So do you not see any, or did you take in a balance at that point?
We did not, the way that we did it, it's very difficult, obviously, to select which people are going to take it and which people are not. What we did purely on this basis is did it on just a proration of liability. So we assumed that, you know, when we say 15% of the people are going to take it, we basically mean 15% of the liability is going to go. So that could either mean a lot of people with a little bit of liability or more people with less liability. But as far as looking at individual patterns, we didn't feel that we had enough information to make a good assumption about that, and we made a.
And I guess as I look at it, an assumption to me in looking at a scenario for this is you're going to have the younger.
Right. Yep.
They're not going to be at the high salary point at this point, but long term they would have been. Yeah. So the impact would be considerably less in the long range because they're coming out of it quicker and not having that long range, higher salary, long term pay piece. But that's. for the actuarial minds to get together later, I guess.
I would say, the only thing that I would say to that is that, respectfully, is that these are a percent of pay. And so everything is a percent of pay. So a person who goes out with a large amount of pay, you know, that's taken into account, you know, because all these numbers are on a percent of pay basis. So there's some of that does come out of the wash.
Other questions? Brad, you know, I thought about why would somebody coming into the system opt for defined contributions? And as I thought about it, you know, if the PERS main plan is 64.7% funded, then their contributions could go to help that recover, or they could have their own fund and start out at 100% funded. So that's a pretty serious implication, I think, mm-hmm. to the whole system.
Sure.
Okay. Sparb, did you
Thank
want
you.
To add something?
I was just going to say, Brad mentioned
move to the microphone, would you?
When these are assumptions in there, but when the plan was originally offered in 1999 to the non-classified state employees, times are different, much more optimistic then, but 38% elected to make the switch. So, you know, we ratcheted that down quite a bit to where we are today. You know, and then, you know, the other thing is, yes, you assume that some of the younger might do it, but we also found back in 1999 that when we send somebody a present value calculation and say, your present value of your fund is $100,000, some people will go, even with longer terms, even if they got long term and they're giving up an awful lot, they'll go, that $100,000 looks pretty good, and they'll mm-hmm. take it. So, you know, it's not always based upon, you know, that other part. And then the other thing is, on the shorter term, right now we're running, in the last several years, I think we're running about 10 to 12% election rates over. And in the last 3 years, it's been around a 5%. So it's gone down a little bit. But as times go up, it'll go up. But that's kind of what we're able to draw upon for it.
Okay. Any questions, Ms. Barb? If not, is there anyone else to speak on House Bill 1452? Oh, you got?
This is just kind of giving the fiscal stuff on
Go ahead when you're ready, Sparman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are just a couple of things. If you take a look at the page 2 on this, Brad had attachment number 1. Brad had mentioned that the cost of this is 1.66% based upon the 15% of the existing group moves over and 10% moving forward. All this does is it drops it down then to show you what the total cost is. That's $28.5 million, of which about 9 is general fund and 10 and 19 is other funds. These costs are spread over political subdivisions, which is something that we'll be talking about as well. Attachment number 2 just shows the cost, how that decreases. If you you know, the one thing is the existing employees get the opportunity to take the full present value. If you put in there that it's the full present value less any associated unfunded liability, you can see that's the difference. That makes it kind of cost neutral to us. So, you know, this is something we'll be reviewing with the sponsors as well. As I said, just came in, so we haven't had the opportunity to go through it in detail. And the last page just shows what our costs that we think are associated with implementation. Since PERS does presently run a defined contribution plan, we don't have all the setup costs, we don't have we don't need additional staffing, we don't have to do all of the things. So as you can see here, most of this is printing stuff, mailings to everybody, and then some informational meetings and some things. And then I might also point to there are some other ways we'll be sharing with the sponsors and how these costs can be mitigated on the system, and And then I won't go through the rest of these considerations and implications, but these are some of the high points taking out of the actuarial report. I know your time's limited, so I'll be able to answer any questions if you have.
Any questions, Aspire? Could you remind me how many people are on defined contributions?
Right now, the eligible group is about 600, and out of that, I think we've got maybe a couple hundred that are in there. About 230 right now that are...
And they do not have the option of moving back and forth at this time?
No, it's, you know...
Does this bill allow people to move back?
Nope.
No? Okay.
It does allow people to move to the D.C., but it doesn't allow them to move back to the D.C.
Okay. Representative Grandy, did you have a question?
Yeah, there's just only one time option.
Oh, okay.
Except for some of these people, they will get a second option now to move. Because those back in 1999 that got the option to move to the D.C. plan are now getting a second option to move to the D.C. plan.
Okay.
If they're still around.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Savalcole.
Chairman Dever.
I apologize in advance. I just noticed my testimony says good morning, Chairman Dever.
It better not be morning when you're done.
Fair enough. We'll say good evening, Chairman Dever and members of the committee. My name is Stuart Savickle, and I am the Executive Director of the North Dakota Public Employees Association. I am here today representing the interests of public employees across the state of North Dakota, including the 2,600 members of NDPEA. At first glance, this bill seems innocent enough. Its sponsors claim that our state employees should have a choice whether to continue participation in the defined benefit plan or whether to have an individualized defined contribution plan. NDPEA has a clear position on this subject, and it is one that dictates our strong opposition to House Bill 1452. Our reasons are both philosophical and fiscal in nature. This bill, if passed, would offer the employee a choice. However, NDPEA would argue that a retirement dependent upon a DC plan is inferior in security and benefit to that provided by a DB plan. To put it simply, these options simply aren't equal, and therefore we hope that you will give this bill an unfavorable recommendation in an effort to prevent individuals from making a choice they are likely to regret. North Dakota state employees have been given the option to opt out of their retirement plan in the past. During the 1980s, the stock market was doing well, and some people were clamoring for the opportunity to control their investments for themselves under the belief that they could outperform the pension fund. They were given this choice, and so great was the remorse that in 1987, the legislature passed a bill that allowed them to buy their way back into the main plan. Coincidentally, that was sponsored by your colleague, Representative Bob Martinson. In 1999, unclassified employees, as Spar mentioned, were given this choice again. Andy Purse has evidence to show, if you have ever seen Spar's presentation, he's got the scatter chart of where all the DC plans are performing in relation to the DB plan. And it's very seldom that any one of those plans is outperforming the main fund. In fact, if given the opportunity to return to the main plan, I am aware of at least 50 of those individuals who made the choice in 1999 who would gladly come back to the plan today if similar legislation were proposed to that which was done in 1987. Defined contribution plans are inferior to DB plans for a few reasons. 401ks were never meant to replace pensions. DB plans provide secure and higher retirement benefits. DB plans are managed by financial experts. DB plans lower costs with pooled risks. DB plans don't age. DB plans boost the economy. And further, by allowing employees to opt out of the main plan, you've already seen this bill would actually hurt the funded status of the main retirement plan. So in essence, every individual who makes this poor choice will in a small way hurt the fund that is meant to provide benefits to everyone who does not make the election. So that concludes my testimony. I again would encourage you to give this bill an unfavorable recommendation so as to provide as much guidance as possible to the House GVA committee tomorrow.
Are there any questions? Appears not. What opinion could the AARP have on this public pension plan?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Employee Benefits Programs Committee, Josh Aspey with ARP in North Dakota. We don't care for this bill either for two main reasons. Specifically, it in theory and practice, I think, is going to end up with taxpayers paying more for a lesser benefit for people. In other words, if you read the actuarial reports and read the fiscal note, it shows that the contributions from the state will have to go up for individuals to be able to transfer out. And then the last piece is that it has the potential to destabilize the system. It's currently at 64% funded, and I think you heard and saw a net effect. I've certainly got a lot more, but in the interest of time, we'll save it for CBA tomorrow, and we certainly would echo Mr. Savickle that it should be given an unfavorable recommendation.
Any questions? Thank you. And then someday she'll get married. And
oh, I did that once.
Oh, she's married.
I did that okay. Once. Then I took the name back. You can't forget this name once you've had it once. Chairman Dever and members of the Employee Benefits Committee, my name is Kayla Pulvermacher, and I'm here representing North Dakota Education Association. I stand in opposition to 1452. In an effort to get you all out of here, because I have a feeling you would really like to do that, I will just echo those comments of my colleagues who went before me, and thank you for the opportunity to address this committee.
Questions? When's the merger vote?
Saturday.
So if the bill was heard next week, you might be speaking on behalf of both organizations. Did you have a question? Representative Gugisberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not necessarily for Kayla, probably for SPARB, if you'd be willing to get up again. It seems like these groups would like to see the choice be able to go both ways. Do you have any idea what it would cost if instead this bill said you could go to a defined contribution or a defined benefit plan? Would there be a cost to the plan if we allowed employees to go from a defined contribution to the defined benefit plan?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it all depends upon the terms that are set up. For example, the cost of this bill would be higher if everybody got a choice every single year to do it. Because it just increases the opportunities for adverse selection. So it depends upon how the terms of this are set up. Now, if the term was set up to say that the people in the defined contribution system today got a one-time opportunity to come back, like the people who are now getting a second opportunity to go to the DC plan, who didn't back in 1999, that was looked at as part of some other considerations. And overall, that one-time choice to come back, if those whole group could be done, actually without a cost. This all varies, though, so much based upon the terms of the offer.
Thank you. If I may continue. It just seems that the testimony we've got, history shows that people may go to defined contribution once and then realize that that was probably a mistake and want to come back. And if we want people, if we want people to have freedom to choose, we should allow them to go to either plan they want right now.
SPARB, I think Representative Benning has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. SPARB, just to be quick. See, somebody that's been in the plan for 10 years making $40,000 a year, what kind of withdrawal would they have out of the plan to go to the DC?
I'm sorry.
Could you bring, this is going to be up tomorrow, is that some information you could bring to the committee? I mean, some examples of what, when somebody, if they choose, I mean, like a different areas, if that's possible, because you're going to have the information if it does pass.
Well, when we do it, if it does pass, this is one of the efforts that shows there. We go out, and it's individual for every single person, and it varies. But, I've just looked at Brad, and he said he can give you some
okay, real, that'd be kind of helpful.
Real general, but two people.
Just something general, because, if it's
$10,000, $100,000 for some of these employees, that'd be kind of...
And it varies, too, based upon the number of years you have left to
correct.
Retire. So, you know, if you got 10 years and you're 30 years old, it's going to be a different amount than if you have 10 years of service and you're 55. So we can give you an example, but it doesn't necessarily translate to other
just an example. Thank you.
Bill, are you going to say something to us? You're going to say, let's all go down to the Peacock.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kalanick, Association for Public Employees. I'm just going to say that I echo the comments of some of the previous speakers, Stuart and Kayla. We feel the same way as an organization as they do with regard to this bill, and would hope for an unfavorable recommendation. That concludes my comments. I have to go pick up my kids. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Anyone else to speak on House Bill 1452? You know, I think there was some allusion to it, but I had a conversation a couple of days ago with somebody of significance in state government, and she didn't tell me that I could use her name, so I won't. But she pointed out that those people that would like to move back from defined contributions to defined benefits would actually improve the status of the fund, because their compensation is considerably higher than the average state employee, so therefore their contributions would be higher. So that's just an interesting consideration that might be taken into account as the House considers the bill tomorrow. Well, I don't see anybody else who wants to speak on House Bill 1452, so let's move back to House Bill 1203. And what our options are to put a favorable recommendation, an unfavorable recommendation, or without recommendation on each of these bills. So if somebody's ready to make a motion, or...
I'll move an unfavorable on 1203.
Yeah. Okay. Motion by Representative Grandy with a second by Senator Holmberg for a not favorable recommendation on House Bill 1203. Is there any discussion? Representative Lauser.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, as you heard, this was heard already in committee. There was one instance where an employee did testify, and in that case, he testified that he would not get a return in the form of a salary increase. And in that school district, the school district paid both sides. So
okay. It
wouldn't have affected this employee either way.
And I suppose in the committee's consideration of the bill, they need to take a look at the actuarial report. Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll ask counsel to call the roll.
Mr. Chairman, the motion is that the Employee Benefits Programs Committee will give House Bill 1203 an unfavorable recommendation.
So yes means no.
Yes means no. Senators Dever.
Yes.
Holmberg.
Yes.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Krebsbach.
Aye.
Nelson.
Yes.
Sorbog.
Aye.
Representatives Bull.
Yes.
Boehning.
Yes.
Brabant.
Yes.
Grandy.
Yes.
Guggisberg.
Yes.
And Lauser.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion prevails.
Okay, then moving to Senate Bill 2331, which a little different approach, the same topic, to increase the benefit.
Unfavorable.
We have a motion for unfavorable recommendation on Senate Bill 2331 by Representative Grandy with a second by Senator Holmberg. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we ask counsel to call the roll. Again, an unfavorable recommendation.
Senators Dever.
Yes.
Holmberg.
Aye.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Krebsbach.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Sorbog.
Aye.
Representatives Bull.
Yes.
Boehning.
Yes.
Brabant.
Yes.
Grandy.
Yes.
Guggisberg.
Yes.
And Lauser.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion prevails.
Okay, then moving to House Bill 1452.
Move a favorable recommendation.
Second.
We have a motion for a favorable recommendation on House Bill 1452 by Representative Boehning and a second by Representative Grandy. Is there any discussion? I think at this point, I'm going to oppose the motion as the bill is currently constructed, and we'll see as it moves across the chamber, across the hall, what it looks like then. So seeing no discussion, ask council to call the roll.
Again, Mr. Chairman and committee members, the motion is that House Bill 1452 be given a favorable recommendation. Senators Dever.
No.
Holmberg.
No.
Kilzer.
No.
Kresbach.
No.
Nelson.
No.
Sorvag.
Yes.
Representatives Bowe.
No.
Banning.
Yes.
Brabant.
Yes.
Grandy.
Yes.
Gugisberg.
No.
And Lauzer.
Yes.
I was going to count, but I got my shoes on. I couldn't. Which way?
No.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the motion is defeated.
Okay, so the motion for a favorable recommendation failed. Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Motion for an unfavorable recommendation on House Bill 1452 by Senator Nelson with a second by Representative Gugisberg. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll ask council to call the roll.
Senators Dever.
Yes.
Holmberg.
Yes.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Kresbach.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Sorbag.
No.
Representatives Bowe.
Yes.
Banning.
No.
Brabant.
Yes.
Grandy.
No.
Gugisberg.
Yes.
And Lauzer.
No.
Mr. Chairman, the motion prevails.
Okay, so each of the bills has an unfavorable recommendation. Is there any other business to come before the committee at this time? I'd like to thank the committee for not allowing the fact that these bills were introduced post-April 1st to be reflected, and with that, we'll adjourn the committee.
I don't know if I'm going to go to the shooting range today.
What's that?